Our next case for this morning is Norinder against Fuentes, 10-2753, etc. Mr. Rosen.
Lawrence Rosen on behalf of the respondent appellant here, Sharon Fuentes, who incidentally is sitting behind me. I hate to get dramatic, Your Honor, but as far back as I can remember, I was always taught that our judicial system is based on guaranteed rights, and those guaranteed rights are due process, a right to a fair trial before a fair tribunal. And I respectfully submit, Your Honor, that what happened and what took place down in the Southern District of Illinois didn't assure my client those particular rights. The issue really here is that if you take a look at the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which the trial court decided to ignore completely in the beginning stages of this case, Rule 1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure state that all civil proceedings before it are governed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I respectfully submit that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were designed, among other things, to ensure due process and a fair trial before a fair tribunal. Rule 1 states, however, that there are exceptions, and it refers to another rule within the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and that is Rule 81. But Rule 81 does not exclude ICARA proceedings as one type of civil proceeding that is not governed by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Well, Mr. Rosen, before you get too much further down this line, I do think you're being a little overly dramatic. The district court had before it a case in which it was obliged by the substantive law of the treaty, which, of course, is part of the supreme law of this country and the implementing legislation, to conduct expedited proceedings. And the court made it very clear in the orders that it issued that it was doing so. You were engaged. You did not, the day after you were engaged, go into court and say, I'm going to need more time to collect pertinent evidence. It wasn't until later that you told the court that. It seems to me the court was entirely within its rights to set an expedited schedule. Courts do that for preliminary injunctions. Courts do that for other analogous situations. So it seems to me a little breathless to say that the court was ignoring the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This is a very experienced district court judge who's well aware of what the rules say.
Your Honor, in response to that, I met with my client on June 16th, and after meeting with her and talking to her and gathering up the facts, before I went down to the Southern District of Illinois, I did file a responsive memorandum, and that responsive memorandum included a request for a continuance and included my affidavit that explained the reason why we needed pretrial discovery. So while I may not have done it a day after I was retained or a day after I submitted my affidavit, submitted my appearance, it certainly was done within a relatively short period of time. And the reason it was done when it was done is because I wasn't going to submit anything prematurely until I had an opportunity to sit down with my client and find out what her case was all about and what evidence we had and what evidence we didn't have. So when you consider the short time frame that all of this arose, the fact that I did do it and did submit an affidavit and was done within days indicates that I had given the court plenty of opportunity to know what we needed to not only prove our case, but disprove their case, Your Honor.
Well, and I can well imagine that the court may have been concerned that you were going beyond the scope of what was properly before it. Because as you well know, under the convention, the only question is whether the courts of Sweden were going to resolve many of these underlying issues about who's the right parent to have custody of the child and to govern his upbringing, or whether there was first of all, what's the habitual residence? If the habitual residence is Sweden, whether it's the courts of Sweden or whether 13B is going to override that. It's a very focused inquiry. Trying to go off into the Hague Evidence Convention, which, by the way, is an entirely separate convention, implemented also by the United States. Unclear to me whether it would be available in these proceedings. I mean, suddenly you're adding years to the length of a proceeding. And this district court judge, I think, said, I'm going to take care of things. The judge says on the record during the hearing on the 22nd of June that he wants Dr. Norinder to submit all sorts of things. As far as I can tell, you didn't then object and say we need to go back before January 2008. Now you're saying that. But I really think the district court was trying to stay focused on the relevant issues.
If you may, Your Honor, if you take a look at the affidavit that we submitted, it was narrowly tailored to the kinds of information we needed to one specific issue that is covered by the Hague Convention.
And what is it that the district court's request, medical records since January 2008, employment records, prescription records, alcohol or drug abuse treatment records, any legal records relevant relative to any domestic abuse or any crimes, any report of investigations. And so that's what the district court tells Dr. Norinder to produce. Sounds pretty comprehensive to me.
There's a couple of problems with that, Your Honor. If you look at the record, when I did ask or try to ask questions that went to the state of his being Mr. Norinder's health before January of 2008, the court, Ms. Dell objected and the court sustained it, and he basically said that I'm not going to let you go back farther than January of 2008. And I explained to the court that the entire purpose was to show a historical evidence, that is, the condition of Norinder even before he married my client, Your Honor, in 2007.
I understand that was your goal, right. But why wasn't the court, for, again, the right. very narrow purposes of this convention, within its rights to focus on the time period that covers this child's life? The child's not born until February of 2008, as I recall.
If you looked at the expert testimony, Your Honor, the basis upon which we were claiming the affirmative defense was the historical and uncurable chronic abuse of alcohol, the historic and chronic abuse of prescription drugs, and a whole history of domestic abuse in this case. So what was important was that this entire history, as Dr. Roth explained, together and collectively created a almost guaranteed grave risk of harm psychologically or physically to the child.
So let me ask you a somewhat different question, because you do explore that in your brief. The district court makes a number of express credibility findings in its order here. Normally, this court defers to such credibility findings. Is there any reason why we should not do so here?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason why is that because the – and this relates back to your other question. While he did say that Norinder was to produce a certain number of limited documents over a limited number of time, there was a substantial amount of other evidence in Sweden that we didn't have access to because we didn't have the ability to compel depositions of other people who had witnessed what happened. We didn't have the ability to compel the production of documents.
Right, and I understand that, and I think the short answer would be that's for you to present to the Swedish court, which will have the ultimate authority over this case.
Your Honor, my point is that the evidence we were seeking was not for the purposes of trying to establish who the better parent was, because I will concede that that's not the purpose of a petition brought into ICARA.
Right.
The evidence we were seeking was to establish by clear and convincing evidence that sending this child back to Sweden posed a grave risk of physical and psychological harm. And
okay.
So I tried to stay focused throughout the entire proceeding, Your Honor, that was the issue before the court, and I'd never try to make this case a case of custody. What I tried to do was to give my client a fair chance by proving our case for one and disproving their case, because with the no pretrial discovery, not only could I not bring forth evidence that would have made my client more credible in its entirety, but I didn't even have the evidence to attack the witnesses they called, Your Honor. I had no ability to take any of the depositions. In many instances, I didn't have the whole range of documents that they may have had. I certainly didn't know who the witnesses are, so I was left with absolutely nothing in my arsenal, if you will, not only not to prove my case, but to disprove their case.
Mr. Rosen, if the district court had done what you wanted to do, how long would this have taken?
Well, I, I will say that I understand that ICARA requires promptness, and I never said anything to the contrary. But I've been involved in...
That's not my question.
Yes, and I'm going to answer your question. He could have set an expedited discovery schedule, Your Honor, and he could have set something that the parties would have exchanged answers and interrogatories within a relatively short period of time. He could have set a schedule for an expedited discovery production. He could have set an expedited schedule.
Isn't that what happened?
No.
You had discovery ordered. It wasn't as broad as you wanted, but you got expedited discovery.
No, I did not, Your Honor. I got one limited thing. I got the court to say to
Okay, Norman, so how long would it have taken? How many trips to Sweden?
I would have said if the court said we had 1 month to do it, I would have done it in 1 month. But 1 month is better than nothing, Your Honor.
Well, the hearings here stretched out over about a month, right?
I would have done it in a month if that's what the court said to do. I would have made it happen, but we had none. I walked down there on the first day, Your Honor, and we were on trial within an hour later with nothing, with no production of documents, with nothing to compel the production of documents, didn't even know what their witnesses were going to say, and certainly didn't have any documents to attack the credibility of the
witness. That sounds like a TRO or a preliminary injunction. I mean, that happens in federal courts all the time. Well, let me ask you one thing that troubles me, Mr. Rosen, about this case, and that is that, yes, it seems to me that somebody who abducts a child because of the perceived grave risk, we accept your client's testimony, notwithstanding the credibility findings that Judge Steele made, but let's take it at face value. I would think that such a person would be pretty well prepared to be able to prove such a critical defense.
If
to take such dramatic action.
That would mean, Your Honor, that before she left in this case.
Before she left Sweden, you mean?
Before she left Sweden and came here to the United States. It suggests that somehow she has the ability to compel the testimony of witnesses that might testify on her behalf, or that she would have the ability to compel the production of documents that the employer might have or his doctors might have, or obtain other information from other agencies that you know they may be willing to give or give up, not give or not give up. But she doesn't have any of those powers at all, Your Honor. So.
You mean you guys have no powers? Well, she was going on a vacation.
Right.
She didn't tell anybody she had to stay, was she?
I'm sorry.
Preparing before she left. Line up witnesses or something. She had.
She had time to do that. And I don't.
Well,
think
when did when did the decision come about when she was going to stay?
She testified that at some point, even when she was on vacation, she was contemplating coming back. But that she had a telephone conversation while she was there. And apparently, or from her testimony, there were things said and things done that made her want to stay here in the United States and not go back to what she was facing in Sweden. That's what her testimony was. So just what I'm in response to your question, Your Honor, there were certain things maybe she had access to that she could get on her own, but there were plenty of things that she couldn't have access to without some court compelling that those individuals either give testimony or produce documents.
So the theory would be that much of this evidence is in Sweden, right? And that the proceedings in the United States should be stayed, in effect, while discovery is pursued under the auspices of Swedish legal procedures. Is that right?
Well, actually, the way it works is that if you take a look at the discovery provisions of the Hague provision that you talked about earlier, Your Honor, what first has to happen is that we have to have a judicial proceeding here in the United States.
Got that.
And it has to be considered a civil or commercial proceeding, I will point out. The
Correct.
Hague Evidence Convention is not an all-purpose evidence convention. I think Judge Hamilton may well be right that whether through the central authority system under the convention or through something more directly, a letter rogatory to the Swedish courts, one way or the other, you're going to wind up in the Swedish courts for what you want.
That, but in the first instance, before that happens, we at least have to have something here in federal court triggering our ability to go to Sweden.
Right. You got that. You got that when Dr. Norander files his petition. Right?
No, because the court there didn't issue any orders.
Well, you have a pending proceeding.
Right.
Okay. But then under one form or another, and there are different alternatives, I don't claim to be an expert in them, but there are different alternatives, but you'd have to go to the Swedish courts and ask them to exercise their coercive power over hospitals, medical records, storage lockers, et cetera. And we'd be asking the Swedish courts to take expedited action on all these purposes in order to prevent themselves, the Swedish courts, from having jurisdiction to decide the custody of this child, right?
No, we're not asking that.
You're Isn't that as a practical matter what we're talking about?
Yes, it is.
That's exactly what you were trying to do. And how long would that take? Months, right?
I don't know, to be honest, how long it would take.
Nor could Judge Steele know, could he?
No, but had he offered us the ability to have done something, even so here in the United States.
Okay, I think we have your point.
Because we never got to that point.
All right.
I guess that's the way of putting
it. Okay. And I, you are out of time, so I do, you certainly explored this in your brief. Rest assured that we have the point. Thank you. Ms. Dale.
May it please the court, my name is Laura Dale, and I represent Dr. Norander, the appellee in this case. With regard to the first issue that's raised on appeal and this issue of noncompliance with the federal rules or error as a matter of law.
Yeah, failure to get any discovery whatsoever is the way Mr. Rosen has put it, and that impugns the fairness of the procedure.
Exactly. But that's not what happened in this case. As the court well knows, this is a proceeding under the Hague Convention, and it's an expedited proceeding. It's, in a sense, an emergency proceeding. Somewhat.
But there's no jury trial right or anything. This is essentially injunctive.
Yes, Your Honor. It is somewhat similar and has been likened by other courts to a habeas proceeding.
Those drag out for years, though. This is a lot closer to a TRO.
And for good reason, because the issue here is the wrongful removal of a child, and the fact that a child will begin to rehabituate to a new surrounding the longer the issue drags out. In this case,
and Ms. Dale, I take it the child in question is right now in Sweden.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the court at the conclusion of the first day of trial ordered my client to sign a waiver, releasing certain records, medical, criminal, employment records to opposing counsel, which was done. But prior to that, and at the commencement of trial, exhibits were tendered to the opposing counsel, which included a substantial portion of the very documents that he requested.
The trial starts June 22, or the hearing?
Yes, the hearing started June 22nd. The child was abducted in March 23rd, I believe, of 2010. So Dr. Fuentes was in the United States part of March, all of April, and most of May, and we did not know where she was at all. She refused to disclose her whereabouts. It took several weeks of investigative work to even locate her, and we found her in the Southern District of Illinois. The court, in addition, heard from four experts, three experts related, medical experts, and then heard a total of eight witnesses over a period of 30 days and 6 days of testimony. Hundreds of documents were admitted into evidence.
Was there any discovery request proffered to the court during this series of, it must have been several different days of hearings?
No, Your Honor. And as the court correctly stated, the first motion for a delay or for a continuance was on the day of trial in chambers before the court, and it's our position that that was properly denied because we felt that it was not timely and because of the nature of the case. These cases are required to be heard and concluded, not required, but it is strongly suggested that they be heard and concluded within 6 weeks.
But, you know, here's the problem on the other side. Every now and then, unfortunately, this court and others have seen cases where a child is at grave risk, and those are not the easiest facts to ferret out. They are, you know, unfavorable facts with respect to the parent in question, and, you know, I'm thinking of the Van de Sand case and other cases. So that particular defense might need a little more time to develop than just a standard habitual residence inquiry, for instance.
And that's true, I think, Your Honor, in any case where a 13B defense is raised. This case was easily distinguishable from the Van de Sand case, because in that case the father had beaten the mother for many years in front of the child and had threatened to kill the mother. I believe it was in the Walsh case, another case involving a 13B defense. In that instance, the child, the father threatened to kill the mother, the father threatened to kill the child, the father threatened to kill the neighbors, and then was charged with those crimes. Even if the court were to accept, which it did not, the testimony of the of Dr. Fuentes in this case regarding her 13B defenses, it's our position that they would not even have risen to the level of what is determined to be grave risk under this jurisprudence. Grave risk is to be narrowly interpreted. It is something to very severe, sexual abuse of a child. There was nothing in this case that would rise to the level of grave endangerment of the child. The records that were submitted, the child's medical records, did not reflect that. The witnesses, the appellant's own testimony, where she stated to the court that my client was a very, very, very gentle individual who loved his son. There was no credible evidence whatsoever that there was a grave risk to this child. My client's employment records, where he was found not to be impaired, not to be a risk to his patients, extensive testimony of his psychiatrist, his treating psychiatrist, over a 10-year period for a form of depression.
So, in fact, did that testimony reach back before January 2008? What was in the record that might have assisted Judge Steele in getting that longitudinal view of Dr. Norander that Dr. Fuentes thought was so important?
Well, I think that Dr. Fuentes testified prior to the marriage, throughout the trial testified that he had a chronic history. All of that was before the court. But even if that were true, it still would not have risen to the level of grave endangerment of a child. These are, and according to the appellant's own expert witness, Dr. Roth, he was there to testify on the question of substance abuse and its effect on parenting ability, something that is exclusively not the purview of a Hague proceeding. That is the purview of the court where the child was a habitual resident. And in this case, certainly Dr. Fuentes had access to ways to compel the records that she complained of. She had filed a divorce in Sweden. She could have used the court in Sweden to produce the very records that she complained of.
Was it pending at the time she traveled to the
U.S.? She non-suited her case, Your Honor, yeah, and moved back in with her husband in January of 2010 and proceeded to negotiate an employment contract in another city where she and her husband intended on moving to. So
were there police reports?
There were police reports that were provided to the court. She had access to them. She was the complainant. At no time did she not have the opportunity to obtain those records. We provided the social study reports. There were numerous social study reports. We provided.
What do you mean when you say social study reports?
She had complained to the social services during this lead up to her to the abduction of the child.
In Sweden. Okay.
Yeah. All of those records were before the court. Her criminal complaints were before the court. The finding of the prosecutor denying or determining that he was not going to prosecute any allegations or alleged crimes that had been committed, according Dr. Fuentes. All of that was before the court. The results of my client's employer's investigation of her allegations that he had a substance abuse problem, the negative test for alcohol, the finding that he was cleared and able to return to work as a surgeon at the hospital where he had been employed for decades, all of that was before the court. And I would argue, Your Honor, this was a substantial amount of information, much more information that is often available in these cases. So I don't believe that the court abused its discretion when it proceeded with this case over a 6-day period, over 30 days, and took heard from four expert witnesses, one of which was over my objection, because the witness testified that he was not familiar with the concept of grave risk under the Hague Convention, and that he was an expert on the effect of substance abuse on parenting ability. And from my perspective, that was an issue that was should squarely be before the court in the court where the child was a habitual resident. It is a custody issue, a traditional custody issue, and not a question of jurisdiction that should have been before the court. So,
could I ask you just one question about the attorney's fees? Because she, despite the fact that, you know, I can see that the district court reduced the request a bit, says that they're still too high, that this is over-lawyered in a sense, and that there's no way she'll ever be able to pay this $150,000-some-odd.
Well, Your Honor, Dr. Fuentes, upon crossing the security line at the airport in Sweden, sat down with her laptop and transferred $40,000 of the party's funds from an account in the name of the child in violation of an agreement of the parties. She had the funds from her severance package. She had funds from a loan that had been secured by my client's elderly parents and guaranteed with a mortgage on his home, on their home. She had all of those funds. She is a physician. She works in the United States. She is a pathologist. And she has stated that, and it's in the record, that her earning capacity is approximately $300,000 a year.
But was that just kind of an idle boast, or was there evidence in the record that she was going to have a job that was going to pay her that? Or?
Well, Your Honor, I believe she is employed at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that, and this was brought up in the brief, Dr. Fuentes contested the fact that that Sweden was the habitual residence of the child. She could have just raised an Article 13 defense, but she went and there was an expense and time dedicated to proving up the fact that the child's habitual residence was Sweden when the overwhelming evidence in this case supported that fact.
And you had to spend time finding her.
We had to spend time fighting it, Your Honor. We had to prepare an expert witness on the issue of custody, rights under Swedish law, and the exercise of right of custody. All of that, in the light of the evidence, to me, was disingenuous. She could have just raised her Article 13 defenses. The fact that the case involved a country where English is not the first language was a complication. We did have to have interpreters. My client was not able to testify in English. There were words that he struggled with. It would have taken much more time for him to have testified in English. There were other witnesses that testified in Swedish. We had to use an interpreter. We had to translate hundreds of pages of documents from Swedish into English. We had to prepare expert witnesses. We had to prepare foreign witnesses. Dr. Vikander testified.
The psychiatrist, yeah.
By phone. So I think that the fact that it took weeks and weeks to find her, we had to hire a private investigator to search for her in Beaumont and Galveston and Dallas and Plano to try and find any lead to locate a needle in a haystack. And because of some of that investigative work, she got wind of this and contacted the central authority and notified them that she had, in fact, abducted the child during a vacation period in the United States, but still did not disclose her whereabouts. It wasn't until I was contacted by opposing counsel on June 8th, and he told me that he would accept service for his client, that we had some idea about where this individual was. So I believe that the attorney's fees were justified and were elevated, if they are, because of this appellant's behavior in this case. She had recourse to the Swedish courts. She didn't like the result that that was going to get. There was no reason for her to non-suit her case.
One assumes the presumed result. As far as I know, the Swedish courts are reliable institutions. We don't presume otherwise about foreign courts.
With regard to, I guess in conclusion, Your Honor, I don't think that the appellant can argue that the district court in this case abused its discretion by putting us to trial on the day on June 22nd, as noticed by the court. This was not the first Hague case that the opposing counsel had tried. We were all very aware of the issues and the gravity of the case and the expedited nature of these proceedings.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Your time may have expired, but I'll give you an extra minute if you will.
It's easy to talk about what all the evidence showed because there was never a level playing field here. All the evidence that they introduced was evidence that they had accumulated over a two-month period and had access to in Sweden, where we only had a few days at most to prepare our case, and we had no access to all the evidence in Sweden that would have proved our case and disproved their case. You know, it's easy to criticize what happened here, but maybe it had been if there had been a level playing field and I had discovery, being able to compel the production of documents and depositions and so on and so forth, we might have had an entirely different result here, Your Honor. Indeed, I submit that we could have produced evidence that had given the chance to establish the issue of grave risk of physical and psychological harm, because the experts seem to all agree that if you have the kinds of problems that we claim Mr. Norander had, sending this child back to Sweden would pose a grave risk of physical and psychological harm. What we didn't have was the opportunity to produce those facts, more of those facts, to establish that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.